So this evening I've been invited to speak about cooling the fire, finding ease, Dhamma reflections on the fire sermon, life and path. Lulu kindly invited me to speak about this. The time that she asked me to speak about this was actually, I think, already maybe more than a month ago, maybe even more than that.
It must have been the middle of summer here, and it was really hot, and I said, can you speak on the fire, please?
I need cool, I need ease. So this particular teaching, this particular sutta has been very important for me in my life and path, and so I'm happy to revisit it. And during this last year, I know that there were fires here in this area, maybe around last September, in several places around the area, and in Northern California, where I live, Sonoma County. Last year we opened our new Bikuni Monastery in Sonoma County a bit more than a year ago. And outside of Santa Rosa, and then big fires came there. The end of our Vasa, our rainy season retreat, which wasn't really rainy season in Northern California. We had a really strong rainy season the year before, and actually all that rain then contributed to various kinds of growth or overgrowth, which actually then in the dry season, the seasonal drought, made for ideal, excellent fire conditions. So we had enormous fire. Many of our local friends, people who we knew, needed to evacuate, even came and took refuge in our monastery. I think there were about 33 fires around. There were a few that were nearby our hermitage, our forest hermitage, Aranyabodhi, the awakening forest on the coast. And there were those fires, even one called the Nun's Fire, which was very close to our monastery. People asked if it was named after us, and in fact, it wasn't named after us. It was named after the Nun's Canyon, where it started, which was originally spelled differently after N-U-N-N, somebody who had been in that canyon years before. So no particular relationship, but internationally then we came to be known as being near the Nun's Fire. And we had firefighters even come from around the world, including from Australia. So our local people particularly loved the Aussie firefighters for whatever reason. Really turned out to welcome. So happy to have Aussie firefighters with us. I can't tell you exactly why we thought that was so great, but for some reason we cheered and turned out. But so much appreciation, and you're really for the heart of like going to where the difficulty is, going to where the, you know, the trauma and the stress and the pain, and having the heart to go there and then work skillfully with that, with love and kindness and goodwill, rather than running away from it, which is, you know, most people try to evacuate, right? And yet there are people coming from around the world who are coming to draw near and try to help. And we saw so much of that, which was really beautiful, that heart to turn rather than to try to get away and like just watch detached from a distance on the screen, you know, everything that I loved and cherished burning down and burning to the ground. As in a way is, of course, the nature of existence, and it's the way sometimes we learn to practice as well. But there's also the heart to, you know, for those who have that love and care and generosity, or there were even prisoners who chose to come out, women prisoners and men prisoners, getting paid very, very little. It's much less than minimum wage, but happy to come out and to do something in a way, like some of them were interviewed, they said it's something they could do to redeem their lives, for some of them, that is to offer really something back to the world and to society. And I so loved and appreciated that, like a chance really for our own hearts for rehabilitation rather than thinking about punishment, you know. I would have liked that they'd be paid more for it, not like slave labor or something, but anyhow, you know, it was a choice, it was an option. They didn't have to do that, and I so appreciated that. And for ourselves at our monastery also, as the fire was coming close and moving very fast, like 40 miles an hour, and we were within a mile distant, and, you know, people asked, we're in an optional evacuation zone, aren't you going to leave? And yet people were coming to us, and there were those who were in firefighting who were coming to have time of meditation together and offering the space of calm, of cooling in our meditation hall to be able to stop, to be able to just take refuge, to be able to just be present with the great horrendousness of all of it and what was happening live and the uncertainty of it, and you know, to listen to the Dhamma, to contemplate the Dhamma in the midst of all that. It seemed so powerful for us in our practice, and also to be able to offer that space. We thought that's what our monastery is here for, in fact, is to be able to do that in the midst of all of the things in life for us. And our hermitage is not so accessible. The idea for the monastery was to be accessible for monastics in sickness, aging, and death, where the steep, rugged mountain hillside on the coast might, you know, might not be, and for everyone, really. And many thanks to those who have been a part of that coming into being. So there was a deep sense in our meditation hall at that time that was remarked upon those who were in the midst of the firefighting, of actually like being in a space where it felt like the flames are kind of all around in the world, and yet that space felt like one of calm, cooling, stopping, peace, refuge, even a sense of like the kind of like the water element or the deep earth element in the Dhamma, which we think have the ability somehow to also, with regards to fire, you know, and work with fire to calm, to quench, to ground. Our Bhikkhu Brothers Monastery to the north, they had mandatory evacuation. They needed to come out in the midst of the night and drive out, you know, with wall of flames on either side, and never knowing whether they would ever be able to come back to their monastery or not. It's quite a large community, and those who are on retreat there also, you know, coming out together, suddenly becoming refugees together with the monks, and watching for over a couple of weeks. It was several weeks before they were able to return, and seeing the fire all around. And you know, in monastic life, we learn these peculiar kinds of things, these blessing chants in the Pali text tradition, ones that we learn that are supposed to be like, there's the quail, baby quail protection, and then also these images of the Buddha with like just standing with hands like this, and some things that as a young monastic that I learned that, you know, raised in the United States, young kind of scientific American, you know, with so much doubt, and I'd say also so much inquiry, a certain amount of open-mindedness to the things. And, you know, we memorized, we're supposed to memorize the chants. And then part of the chant is like, fire, go back, making, really? Can we do that? Actually? And in a way, being very skeptical about it. And in another way, also not wanting to judge too quickly and wanting to be open-minded and to be able to like have an open eye and open heart to experience what is actually there in this path of practice. Then I found in my time in South Korea, where I have a bhikkhuni mentor, earlier on in my monastic life in Theravada Buddhism, there were no elder bhikkhuni mentors available. I had exclusively bhikkhu teachers other than Ayakema earlier on, and Ayakema died the very year, 20 years ago, of my own ordination as a bhikkhuni. I felt it good for myself to have Bhikkhuni mentor and to touch into the old Bhikkhuni's tradition. I remember one time going with her in South Korea. There had been a fire there. And then I remember in the monastery we heard news of like the fire coming down the hill and that the Bhikkhuni who was there got the mandatory evacuation order, but she chose not to. She decided to stay in the hall and chant and meditate. I heard this news and I'm thinking, oh, really? Is that wise? Is that smart? Is she being kind of fanatical? Or what is this and what's going to happen with this, right? And then we went into our hall there and then we were chanting together and thinking about, you know, her hall that she went into is like just at the edge between just the natural, just nature on the hillside, on the mountain there. And then below her hall was where the rest of the kind of like suburbs and then going down into the city was. So she was at the boundary, yeah, on the edge of the mountain, like the edge of civilization, you could say. So others below evacuated, but there she is at that border space. And so then we went to chant together into the hall. And then about a week later, for whatever reason, I didn't hear exactly what happened, but we didn't hear that she had died. And we did hear that the fires had, you know, come to be taken care of and gone out. And then as she was a Dhamma sister, then we were invited, my venerable Bhikkhuni mentor and other Dhamma sisters were invited to go visit. So we came up into that area there. And then she invited us to come up into that hall, and then we walked around the hall and we could see how the fire had come down, like just to there, and then just stopped at where the hall was on the top of the hillside. And she was just, you know, calm and cool and comfortable and confident about it. And that's what she felt would happen somehow. And I looked at this and, oh, interesting. So then later on, when these fires were there in Sonoma County, then also for our monastery area and for our hermitage, then there were the nights that I stayed awake overnight, and also for these chants and for kind of like that meditation, that in that image that I had before, like just fire stand back like that, and thinking about, in terms of what I'd learned from meditation practice for the sense of burning of things and how we can also bring a kind of cooling in our mind, like bringing the water, like sweet, healing, cooling water or grounding, and bringing earth into those things to ground them, to bring them down, to calm, and for that, you know, for that fire to just come down, go out like that, to just stop right there. That's something in ourselves that we also learn, we may experience in this practice, like applying that as we learn also with different things, like we were talking yesterday about metta bhavana or maitri bhavana, the brahma viharas, and like radiating out the loving kindness, radiating out the compassion. We learn, we're trained in that kind of you know, not only the internal radiation and recognizing how our mind, how our consciousness is applied to our bodies, how it's applied to our feelings, how it's applied to our minds themselves, but also externally, really being sensitive to that, because these are like the inflows and the outflows that we all have sense spaces for, and, you know, the way that our minds work, even if we're blind, still we're taking in, and you know, visual consciousness is likely also still there. So there's the taking in of experience and the outward flow and expression of experiences, as it turned out. But I can't take all. We can't take all credit for it, but as it turned out, for our Bhikkhu Brothers Monastery, Abhayagiri, in fact, they had 10 battalions of firefighters who moved in and were there in residence for a little while in the perimeter of the monastery also. There's the hill coming down the forest, the fire was burning down, and there's a trail around the perimeter of the monastery, which goes around where the kutis, the little meditation huts, cabins in the forests are, and the main area. And the firefighters said that they saw the fires coming down. They're there. They're preparing that trail, like, you know, cutting into the earth there to make a fire break. But they saw, even without back wind, like the fire came down and then the fire reversed and went back up again. So a big surprise for them. They couldn't properly account for it, but a few of them who were senior firefighters said that they'd seen similar things in other monastery fires before. So just one of those things that firefighters see sometimes, sometimes in their lives. And so just interesting to see that. In the case of our monastery, then, you know, there were the other bigger fires with other larger commercial investments that were in other areas where the effort was really going to firefighting. In our area where the fire was coming in nearby our monastery, there wasn't so much, you know, firefighting going on there. But some of our local neighbors, an old guy brought out his old, like, what is it? What's it called? Not heritage tractor. Antique tractor. He got out his old tractor and he went out with his kids and his partner and went out, and he just went out into the fields with the old tractor and he just plowed a fire break around the whole area there. So he just went out, and then other local neighbors just went out to join in doing that together. But there were the wild things that happened at that time. With him doing that and the danger to our area seeming like it was coming down, then there were also some young people and some who weren't so young who were like, other people's places are getting burnt and they're on the news and our area's not. And they went out to start fires. So there were those who were found in the fields even while that plowing was going on in the evening who had gone out to actually set fire to those fields there for whatever reason. I was trying to understand the psychology, like why... why would they do that? Why would they go out to do that? Yeah, and really just, you know, there were those who were just damning and condemning them and like, take a shotgun out and go take those guys out. How can they be doing that? But my thought wasn't exactly like that, but really to try to understand, you know, what is it? What is it in us that can actually desire these things for, I don't know, for excitement, for entertainment, to feel important, to feel like being a part, or, you know, also to just see so much destruction and something inside oneself, also just desiring that burning up and that destruction and self-annihilation like this. You know, so I thought, let me try to understand this. And I do know something about this, in fact. As a younger person in the United States, before going into monastic life, then I have to say, for our teenage culture, it's not that I didn't have some experience of this, actually being pretty strong in the culture. It was there. There was that. And when we talk about like the desire for becoming or the desire for annihilation, these things, it seems like, you know, to call one a kind of craving and desire for the other to call it a kind of craving seems strange, and yet there can be that in us. Yes, these two forces may be there, and if they get fed or if they're like burning underground, I'd say, then if fuel is there and something activates them, then they flare. They come out, then we understand with that flaring of these things because of some fuel, because of some spark, then we can see how they can come up within us, yeah? And understand about this process. Sometimes we think, like some of those who are talking about taking out the shotgun, maybe they were thinking self-righteously, I'm a very good person, right? So as a defender of our neighborhood, let me go kill those guys. just think, oh, you know, what is arising with that righteous indignation and anger also? It's like thinking of taking the gun to somebody else. You know, how these things can come up like that. So just looking with interest and openness to understand in light of the Dhamma, in light of the Buddha's teaching, in light of this path of practice, what these things are, you know, how they work. So also not to be too quick to damn the ones who are damning and the ones who are going for the shotgun either, but to understand as well, you know, about that. Yeah. But I felt very happy at that time to be on the side of those, like, offering a refuge, offering a sanctuary, offering a place to be able to calm, cool, also to recharge with what's healthy and wholesome. So many others were offering food, so many others were offering alcohol, so many others were offering, you know, various kinds of things to be of support to all those who were offering help and offering care, and all of those who were displaced, also like entertainment. And, you know, this is the funny kind of thing there that I found interesting, because the offering of entertainment to those who are then refugees, is, you know, there are different feelings about it. Like some people, yes, distract me from this, please. I really want to put my mind on something else. My mind really needs a break to be distracted, to time out in that kind of way. And others are like, entertainment? Really? In the midst of this? Or alcohol? Really? So very different perceptions about, you know, how it's good to be with the things and what we are as human beings, what kind of abilities we have. And many people did not understand themselves to have the ability to be able to just be with the things as they are, and also to be responsive and to help each other, and understood in themselves that, you know, to, like, to opt out, to go to entertainment or to numb, to dull with the alcohol, that's like the good way to be with things like this as human beings. So very interesting to see even our self-concept and also our resources, what we've seen, what we understand we have the ability to do. Those who came to us during this time were largely those who had the self-concept, who had some sense there is a way to be with this that's healthy and even excellent, even some mentioned like the feeling of sublime to have such a space to just stop and cool and quench and be present like that. So, you know, in the midst of what would be called a disaster, then touching into a sublime perception without any drugs or alcohol, without any other entertainment, other than, you know, just being able to be present with the things as they are in such a way that we learn, even in basic mindfulness and clear awareness practice in this path. You know, how deep, how profound, even this very basic, sometimes people think this is like just beginner stuff and then you're going to go on to what is more deep and more profound and more excellent. And yet, you know, there is what is so deep and profound, and even the basic fundamental teachings for the Buddha then speaking about the mindfulness and clear awareness as ekayana, like hub or core practice that all the other folds of the path touch into, draw from, are connected to, are rooted in. Actually, it's that big, that central, that important. Yeah, even for our samadhi, even for, you know, our deep jhana meditation, also rooted in mindfulness or no? According to the suttas, yes. And for those who are meditators, if we look at how our experience works, if we understand what part of the, you know, path folds, like what is what, then we can see also how that works. And for insight to happen, for penetration into the path, to be able to see and know and look into, then, well, that's there. We're not just zonkered out. Although, like the computers sometimes to shut down for just a little while, to reboot as a way for our system to like reset, go back to its home program again, and then see what it's like coming out of that. There is that in the deep meditation practices, but coming back out again, as soon as awareness begins to generate, then there's the mindfulness and the sampajanya that enables us to know, to see, to know, to understand what we're seeing, what we're knowing. Yeah. So I'd like to come now to the fire sermon, the Adita Pariyaya Sutta, with that little intro. And for the Pali, Adita or Aditya is the fire, and Pariyaya, in many of the suttas, if one reads and recites them in Pali, as I've had the real blessing and good fortune to be able to do together with our international Sangha in India and also in Berkeley, California. Now we've had 4 years of international Tipitaka chanting. Then we recognize in many of the suttas we find Pariyaya and even the Buddha talking about his own methodology in teaching as Aneka Pariyayena, through innumerable expedient means, we can say, through innumerable methods. So here the Pariyaya is a way of setting forth the teaching. It's an expedient, it's a method, and using fire as the basis for that expedient means. So Adita Pariyaya Sutta. I'd like to give you some context for this sutta. According to the Pali text tradition, the Buddha awakened under the Bo tree, spent some time, some weeks in meditation, reflecting back on what he had awakened to, also some time in gratitude meditation, just looking back at the tree and back at the seat that had supported him in that. So gratitude for the tree, and we still hold these bow trees as so important. Even at Bodhichan Monastery yesterday, their beautiful heart form with their delicate tips planted around. I saw in the garden and 8 trees in the front entryway there. They weren't called bow trees at that time, or Bodhi trees. Even the name, Latin name Ficus religiosa, comes later because of the Buddha's awakening, so it's called the religious fig, right? But it's just a kind of fig tree, yeah? And yet why it's called the Bodhi tree is because of the Buddha's awakening beneath that tree. So the Buddha then, after his awakening, then set off to walk towards Varanasi, and in the rishis, the sages, practice area in the deer park, then we say turned the Dhamma wheel or set the Dhamma wheel in motion, teaching to 5 ascetic companions, the first 5 bhikkhus. And with that first teaching, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the setting the Dhamma wheel in motion, then he taught basically the salient things that he had realized, and then in contemplating how to teach, you know, how to set forth what he'd understood in an effective way, then one among those 5 ascetics opened the Dhamma eye. And then in the sutta, then there's like kind of rejoicing going, resounding through the heavenly realms with one more person, another person, being able to see and know and understand. So the first disciple to be able to do so, which means the teaching can be communicated effectively. There's not just one Buddha in the world. But then we say the Sangha also came into being with the second teaching, the Discourse on Non-Self, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the characteristics of non-self. Then we have 5 awakened ones, 5 arahantas emerging in the world, and an increasing number. The Buddha then mention to those awakened disciples gave a kind of a direction, saying, for, what is it, Bahujana Hitaya, Bahujana Sukaya, means Bahujana is the many folk, for the welfare and well-being of the many, for the happiness of the many. Go forth, O ye bhikkhus, not two of you together, according to the text, and sent them out far and wide. They were also already awakened ones at that time, to look out for those who didn't have so much dust in their eyes and who might be able to benefit from the teaching. No imperative, like you have to convert everyone or that kind of thing, but just with the heart to share for the benefit and for the happiness of people, of the many. Yeah? The Buddha himself then took off on a walk and walked towards a place called Gaya Sisa, Gaya's head. So Gaya, we think about meaning like old name for the earth, and then Bodh Gaya, also that area is named Gaya, and Bodh Gaya, Bodhi, is just because of it being the site of awakening. So there's a whole area there called Gaya, and river passing through there, an area called Gaya's head. And the Buddha went to that spot where there were a lot of other ascetics at that time, and according to the text, those ascetics had like dreadlocks, so they let their hair grow wild and kind of mat together in long strands, and they were fire worshippers. So that was their spiritual path, the worship of fire. And this is something that still exists in India to this day, and even is very ancient. So the idea of like the sun even being a god or representative of God, or just the idea of the sun being a source of life, or of fire being so very powerful in human life, and then having discovered in humanity also how to have some control, a little bit of control, tiny bit of control. How to start fire. We learned how to start it. We didn't necessarily learn how to put it out, but we learned how to start fire, and something about how to put it out as well. And that was considered to be really, really important and special and precious. And people at that time keeping the hearth fire burning, and then also in religious life, the worship of fire, the tending of the sacred fire, even amongst Brahmins contemporarily in India and abroad, this tending of the sacred fire is still there as a practice, even thousands of years later. So there were three main teachers, all with the ancient sage name of Kasapa or Kashyapa, and named after each of the areas there. Like Gaya Kasapa and Uruvela Kasapa, and then Kasapa of the river was also there. And one had a following of 500 other ascetics, and the other had a following of 300 other ascetics, and the other had a following of 200 other ascetics. They were all fire worshippers, and so they had their dreadlocks, and they had their implements for fire worshipping ascetics, which still exists, a kind of gear for this kind of practice. And then also as part of that, then they lived on the riverbanks, and they went down to the river, and then they took many baths. So a lot of baths at particular times, and so they're tending the sacred fire and also many baths for purification. And so that was the, you know, their religious life and practice. And those who were the leaders thought that they were maintaining the ancient sacred tradition and that they were perfect ones. So they had this idea. The Buddha, understanding about them, they're making all this effort, and they have this idea they're perfect, and many people believe in them, and many people come to them to make offerings and think that by them doing that, that's going to assure them like a good future birth, or, you know, heaven after death, or that they're going to be able to get wealth or get benefits in life, or be able to prevent or cure sickness or disease, or all these kinds of things. People had those ideas, so went to them, and then they had like festivals for people to come and make many offerings and have great sacrifices and things like that. So the Buddha, with his awakening, knew about that, and that this was like a big religious thing going on in that area, and many people believe that that is the spiritual path, or that is the religious path. So then he also went off walking in that area, and walking there, then came to meet one of the Kashyapa leaders, and there was the fire hut, which had a snake inside it. And then meeting with that Kashyapa leader then asked if he could spend the night in the fire hut. And, you know, apparently no one stayed in the fire hut with that snake, not even the great Kashyapa, nor the other ascetics. So he said, basically, at your own risk, if you really want to, then yes, you can. The Buddha said he would just go inside and meditate in there. And according to the story, which we actually find in our Vinaya, our monastic discipline, there's quite a lot of suttas and, you know, Dhamma texts that come into Vinaya, and then in the suttas themselves, then we find Vinaya. So that these categories that are there are not so exclusive. So we find suttas in Vinaya, and we find Vinaya in suttas, and, you know, there is a certain amount of mixing that I think was the nature of the early path, in fact, before those who like to categorize things and put this in this basket and put that in that basket and put the other in the other basket, before they're divided out like that. So we see some remnant of how these things were really, you know, together, live. So the Buddha then was meditating in the hut with the serpent, and apparently those on the outside then saw the hut glowing in the night and smoke coming out of the hut and some kind of something amazing happening. And then, you know, is the ascetic Gotama going to be able to emerge from this hut in the morning or not? What's going on? But at his own risk, right? So according to the story, then in the morning he emerged from the hut, and then he was carrying his bowl, his alms bowl. And then when he saw this Kashyapa leader who remarked upon him still being alive after all that glowing and rumbling and smoking overnight, then he opened up his alms bowl and the snake was inside. And then Kashyapa was impressed, but he thought that he was still the supreme perfect one. And then the story goes on in different ways. Then the Buddha shows his the mastery that he had gained. But still, this teacher, this leader, thought he's, you know, the master. He's the perfect one, until finally the Buddha decided to just speak directly to him. And he just then told him straight, up front, what you're practicing is not going to do it for you. It's actually not where it's at. And at that moment, he had a kind of a turnaround, a change of heart, a clarity, an awakening, and then bowed down to the Buddha and asked the Buddha to become his teacher, and that he asked if he could go forth as a disciple of the Buddha. So something switched. He had been responding with a certain kind of arrogance, no matter what the Buddha showed him, and then suddenly there was a gap in that arrogance and a gap of opening. But the Buddha mentioned, you have so many students, are you sure you want to do this? And he went to talk to his students, and his students said, well, actually, we've been quite impressed by that ascetic Gotama during this time, except we honored you as a teacher, and yes, that would be excellent. Can we also? And so they, according to the story, cut off their dreadlocks and let go of all of those implements, which were then seen going downstream. And the other Kashyapa brothers then saw this, thought, what happened? Their locks, their fire implements, all floating downstream. Surely some disaster has come upon them. And went then to inquire and found them there practicing with the teaching of the Buddhas with very different demeanor. Sons without all of those implements. And then the one Kāsapa brother asks the other, is this better, actually? And the first one answers to his brother, it is better. Just simple, like that. And then he too asks, and the others ask, if they can as well. And likewise for the third brother. Until then, there were 1,000 disciples gathered. And then this is the time that the Buddha then delivers the fire sermon. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So within that context, I'm going to just shift position here to be kind to the body. If you need to also, you can. I hurt my knee a couple of weeks ago. It's still healing. We'll let it be able to heal. So this Fire Sutta is deep and profound. With the teaching of the Fire Sutta, according to the text, then the number of arahantas radically increased. Because at the end of this particular teaching, the text says then there were 1,000 arahantas in the world. So this is quite amazing and incredible. Of course, they had been applying themselves diligently, trying to practice, you know, for some time. Only what would work? What would be helpful? What could have actually the effect of, like, clearing their minds, penetrating the delusion, opening up and seeing the things as they are, and experiencing the effects of that. That was the part that they didn't have. So it seems that all of them somehow were amazingly ripe and ready. Perhaps that's why the Buddha walked in their direction at that time, himself alone, to meet them. Later on in the story, then he, after that, then goes with the 1,000 arahants to meet his old friend, who he had promised to come back and see again if he were to gain awakening and success in the path. From that we get in the suttas the group of the 1,250 arahantas that we find in some of the suttas. So in the fire sermon, how many of you are familiar with it? It's not that long, yeah? It's quite, you know, pithy, and even it's quite short, there's a certain amount of repetition in it. The Buddha mentions, how does it start?
Bhikkhus, all is burning.
Bhikkhus, all is burning. And what is burning?
The things of the world.
The eye. No, the Buddha mentions the eye is on fire, the ear is on fire, the nose is on fire, the tongue is on fire, body is on fire, mind is on fire. And if we look actually at biologically, at our sense bases and our bodies and life, then we can recognize, in fact, there is combustion going on with having a body. Yes? That is what it means to have a body that's alive, is there is this process of taking in fuel and then burning fuel. That's why the body has warmth. Yes? And that is what we call life in biology 101, nutriment. Life exists based on nutriment. And we recognize also for ourselves, if we have eyes, then sights, what we see, becomes nutriment for us. There may be craving. We may crave to see particular things. We may feel satisfied to see particular things. Or other things, if we see them, we may feel gravely dissatisfied. Yes? There are the sites that we reject. There are the sites that we feel we would like to get rid of. And for sounds as well, how sounds become a nutriment, how we can feel satisfied as if we've been fed in a way by sounds that we find pleasing, also by smells that we find pleasing or smells that we find unpleasing. Then also to recognize there's both like feeding on what we find pleasing, and then also there's the way that this process of consumption works with regards to what we find unpleasing or displeasing. For some people, that part becomes very important, actually. There's so much feeding on aversion, so much feeding on what is dissatisfying or unhappy or what we don't like or what we're against, and how that occupies our minds, yes? Or even how we can feel compelled somehow by a strange kind of craving to see, to engage with the things through our sense bases and through our mind, like thinking about the things that make us so unhappy or that make us angry, or and you know, that being a part of the consuming process, that being part of the meaning of our life, to be giving our life energy, to be thinking about these things and to be running the emotions, what it is to be feeling the emotions of anger, for example. And I know many people feel anger like fire, like a burning, or feel desire like fire, like a burning. We talk about lust also as being like a fire. Yes, the Buddha is speaking about then in this sutta also of the fires of desire and of the fires of hatred, anger, aversion, and even speaking of delusion as a fire. Now, I've been interested in this particular part myself recently, as I see in the world perhaps a little bit more clearly a kind of delusion mongering, and how that can be consuming. You know, how much energy can go into these things and how they can be consuming, how confusion can also be like that. It's not the way that I learned to look at it, and we don't normally speak about it like that. We talk about the fire of lust, we talk about the fire of hatred or anger, we don't talk about the fire of delusion normally in English. And yet, if we look, if we see, if we look into it, we can start to understand. And even, although in the sutta it talks about these three, there are other places, also in Vinaya, where there's a fourth that's talked about, and that is the poison or the fire of fear. And I can see for fear-mongering and how fear can spread like a fire, can spread like a flame, how it can ignite our hearts, how it can consume us, how it can be like an underlying fire also, just like embers that are burning down below. And, you know, for the deep meditation practice, for the jhanas, one of the things that people experience at a particular level of deep meditation is there's a way where it gets down and touches into and can even quench the fear part. So touching into that, and then what is it to experience a freedom from that fire of fear? To enter into this kind of deep meditation also, then that kind of raga, that kind of lust and desire being active as a fire, then that can be a hindrance. If we're obsessed with that, if that's where we're applying our minds, if that's where we're applying our energy, at the time we're doing that, it's very hard to enter into such deep meditation. We have to, at least temporarily, at least for that time, to, what is it, divest? Not invest, but divest our life's energies from that in order to be able to access and enter into the deeper meditation. And the same also for the aversion, the active anger and hatred. If we're running that, then, you know, our minds, our energies are going to be filled with and consumed by that. That's what our life energy is going to be burning up with. All that food that we're taking in and all of our resources and everything are just going to be like being, I don't know, shoveled into that fire or like fuel for that fire. Yeah. So we have to stop that at least temporarily in order to access this deeper meditation. And then with the clarity of seeing and knowing, that clarity of awareness, then also the part that's binding with delusion, then also that starts to go out, calm down, become clean, clear, fresh, the sense of fire, the sense of the ongoing kind of burning in that, which you might have never been aware of before, I'm not sure. Many times it's just going on, and unless we actually point our awareness to it, we don't see it. But when we do look at it, then we can sense, we can feel, we can see what it is when it's present, and also what it's like in the absence. How, when we see and know things clearly, what that's like, the difference that there is in terms of that kind of active burning, active consuming or burning up of the fuel of our life, how that becomes clear, and how there's a sense of that energy then, that life energy becoming bioavailable to us in a very different kind of way, which then can even be the energy of the clarity, the energy of the joy, the energy of the deepening of our mind and the coalescing of our awareness, our ability to see and know clearly and penetrate into the path, because that's all that energy then becomes bioavailable in a very different kind of way. Like it makes a difference with fuel, how it's being burned. Yeah? The way that it's burned is actually important, and even for the fuel itself, somehow there's the fuel that's like dirty fuel, yeah, and then there's what we could consider much more clean fuel. And for human beings in these regards, there is a big difference in this, yes, which I think you may recognize experiencing in your own path of practice. So the Buddha is then asking, on fire with what? And then speaking about these particular things, which they apparently are able to recognize in their own experience. And I imagine that many of you also are able to recognize in your own experience when seeing in such a way. But again, the self-conception is so important. Many people think, this is my identity. This is human life. These things, these stories, these angers, these desires, this lust, all of this isn't that life itself. And if one is not actively engaged in burning these things, what does that mean for us? Now, all of you may actually, perhaps, have a sense of that through your own experience, through your own awareness, and understand how good, how fresh, how clear, how wonderful, how amazing that is possible in human life. And it's not like our identity just ceases to exist with that, yeah? The basis for our sense of identity, our awareness, are so various what consumes our attention and our lives. Many times even when these things calm down and clear, people feel, I've heard it described as somehow like having come back into themselves, having come home, being able to finally be present and aware in themselves, occasionally even describing it as an experience of feeling all the more really like themselves. It's just a use of language, right? But you know, when the Buddha is teaching in this sutta and also the one just before, the discourse on non-self, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, it has shared material there. He's talking about the things that people often so tightly identify with, cling to as themselves, which are so transitory, shifting, changing, the body shifting and changing, the feelings shifting and changing, even the things that we make in our minds, the mental fabrications, even to the consciousness. Even the Buddha is talking about consciousnesses, not just one permanent, inalienable consciousness, but consciousness arising and consciousness also ceasing. Eye consciousness arising with sight, and then ear consciousness arising, appearing and disappearing, based on contact, based even on there being a nutriment or a ground for arising, and then another with its ground for arising, integrated together, something like our contemporary technology. If video is happening, the way that the sound is being recorded is one thing, and the way the image, visual image, is being recorded is something else. Yeah? And then these two things then get put together for us too, like sankharas, woven together, such that we have this experience that we're having now, which seems like a unified experience somehow, and can create what seems like a unified sense of self. And yet, when we look at it, this is the visual part, this is the auditory part, this is the part that's smell, this is the part that's taste, this is the part that's touch of the body, and there's the part that's mind and mind consciousness. Looking at all of these things, these aggregates coming together, each one as it is. And the question is self, the essential self or innate self, actually contained within any one of these imperishable, inalienable? And for those who awakened with this teaching, looking into it with the power of their insight, the power of their meditation, seeing change, seeing evolution, seeing all of these things coming together. At a later time, someone then asked the Buddha for this teaching on what is not self, on the things that shouldn't be considered to be the Atman, which could also be called the soul, like is the soul the body? Is the soul the feelings? Yeah? Looking at these, yeah. Seeing what is not, but finally when being asked, would you say there is not self or there is self? Saying that neither is really the, even neither is not the right description. Both not the right description. So I just want to recognize now, with thanks for the heads up, that if anyone wishes to go at 7:45 or 8 p.m., that we have come to that time now. And I would just like to say one last thing with regards to this text, and then offer time for anyone who wishes for a couple of questions or discussion. In this text, there's one word that's repeated over and over again with regards the experience of those who were listening in their awakening process. And this word is nibindati. And this word has been translated in some very peculiar ways. Venerable Nyanamoli translated it as estrangement. I.B. Horner as disregarding. And Venerable Tanisiro Bhikkhu as disenchantment. I would like to talk just a tiny bit about this word and my understanding of its meaning. I actually like the last best. In this word, it's talking about what we make our basis for the fueling of our life. And then with clear awareness and recognition, also how we can withdraw. When we see, when we know something is a poison or something is consuming in a way that's not healthy, how when we recognize that there's an intention or a natural inclination to come out of that, seeing and knowing that. When we recognize it clearly for what it is, then that delusion that was in there, consuming, comes out, and are just behaving blindly, compulsively, in those ways. We don't need to do that anymore. Because we have the awareness, we can step back, we can step out. It doesn't mean detaching from life, exactly, but just for the things that are poisons. When we see, when we know, we see the ability to come out. And we realize also, I'd say, even the bliss, the ease that there is then in being free of that kind of burning, that kind of compulsion, feeling like a slave to these things, not a slave anymore. Yeah. We can then be intentional, aware, choiceful, understanding the processes of life, how these things work. And also knowing the clearing, and I'd say like the bliss of the absence of the freedom of these things. So I'll stop there. Lulu knows my challenge for speaking about Dhamma in brief. I'm going into the